Advocates and the Promotion of Access to Information Amendment Act.
We have a tight program which must start now until 1 o'clock. We will appeal to presenters and to members to be straight to the point so that we can be able to finish on time. So that at 2 o'clock we can be able to go to the sitting of the National Assembly. Presenters that are here will start with Amabungane Center for Investigative Journalism. They will be followed by Alan Gray. Then they will be followed by Mr. James Tunbridge. And then Mr. Tunbridge will be followed by the Right to Know. And then the last one for today will be the South African Human Rights Commission. We will give each presenter about 15 minutes. That will be followed by 15 minutes of questions. Those presentations are going to assist us in our deliberation when we consider the bill clause by clause. We will also take into consideration the presentations that were made and also some written presentations, because other people did not elect to come and make oral presentations, but they have made written presentations. We attach the same weight to oral and written presentations in guiding our discussions as we process the bill. So can I now invite a person representing Amabungane?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. My name is Karabo, and I'm from the Amabungane Center for Investigative Journalism. As this is the first presentation to the 6th Parliament Justice Portfolio Committee, I thought it may be of assistance to re-present Amabungane to the committee. We are an independent, non-profit, independent media company that was established in 2009. We are independent, so we do publish through other media, though we also self-publish. We made the submission as part of our advocacy mandate, which is to secure the information rights that investigative journalists need to do their work, but also in the wider public interest, and that's part of our NPC mandate. Our interest, or our advocacy mandate, just to give you a sense of it, because I think more people know about our investigative journalism rather than our advocacy work, the intention of our advocacy work is to strengthen legislation to allow for the free flow of information, for media investigative journalists to inform the public about matters of public interest, including for the matter at hand, political party funding. We believe that as we practice investigative journalism, we are best placed to identify the legal policy as well as practical threats.
Sorry, ma'am. There is a request that you become a little bit slower so that members can follow. And I hope you're not investigating any of our members for now.
Absolutely. Thank you. Okay. I shall continue. Since 2000, we've been doing submissions to Parliament since 2010, where we have made a number of submissions on policy and legislation, including the Companies Act Amendment Bill, the Protection of Personal Information Act, the Protection of State Information Bill, as well as the more recent Political Party Funding Act of 2018. Our interest in the bill, and I think I should first start by saying we welcome the steps that Parliament and this committee have taken to amend legislation and comply with, in compliance with the Constitutional Court order in the My Vote Counts versus the Minister of Justice and others matter. Our interest in this bill is to ensure that this legislation ultimately meets the end of securing information rights in the wider public interest, but also to ensure that the constitutional right to information and powers in power is given effect, as well as allowing civil society, members of the public and media, as well as Parliament, to monitor as well as exert accountability on political parties. We make a number of comments on this draft bill. There are seven different areas we should comment on, and then we make a few additional comments which are more about wider issues on the application of this legislation. The first relates to the prescribed threshold for disclosure in this draft legislation. As it stands right now, the prescribed threshold for disclosure is set at 100,000 rand, and this may be to be in alliance with the threshold prescribed in the Political Party Funding Act of 2018. On principle, we believe that the 100,000 threshold is too high, and we'll go into reasons for this in the next slide. But our key submission here is that the prescription of 100,000 should not be contained in statute, so in the actual bill itself, but this should be left to regulation. And the reason for this is simple. If we're going to prescribe a specific threshold in statute, should that threshold change at any time, it will require a full legislative amendment process, whereas to put it in regulation will allow it to have a lot more flexibility. And this is the same practice which is adopted in the Political Party Funding Act, where the threshold for disclosure is in regulation and not in statute. The reason why the 100,000 is far too high is that it creates additional areas of concern about the possibility of the splitting of donations below the threshold. So if the threshold was lowered, these issues may be resolved. However, should Parliament and this committee maintain the threshold of 100,000 rand, a number of safeguards are going to need to be put in place to ensure that any loopholes or splitting of donations below the threshold do not take place. To do so, we say that the bill will need to provide some kind of definition for donations which are substantially related sources. In our main submission, we provide a definition of what a substantially related source could be. But so the only way to ensure that a potential donor or donors don't try and split and hide their donation, this will need to be addressed adequately in the legislation. We also submit that this particular legislation should ensure that the gap in disclosure of party investment vehicles should be addressed in this amendment. So in other words, funding from party investment vehicles should be disclosed above the threshold, and this should be provided for in the list of sources of donations in the PIE amendment bill. Our next area seeks to address the duty to create and hold records, which is a direct reading from the Constitutional Court order. The draft bill only places an obligation for political parties and independent candidates to create and hold records above the threshold of 100,000. Our view is that this is inadequate. The Constitutional Court in its order placed a discretion on Parliament to consider what the appropriate threshold for the creation and holding of records should be. So in other words, Parliament can go far beyond just simply adopting again the 100,000 threshold. Our submission is that we say that Parliament should create a general obligation on political parties and independent candidates to create and hold all records, irrespective of their value, to effectively meet their constitutional obligations under PIE. And now to do this wouldn't be an administrative burden on political parties. This is part of standard accounting practice to keep records of the income and expenditure of political parties. So we're simply saying that the duty should go far below the threshold, which is currently set at 100,000 rand. The intention of this, the effect of this, will be to ensure that the gap created by the disclosure threshold change. My apologies, there's a bit of a typing error here. But I think the essential point here is that all record keeping should be below the 100,000 record, and this is standard accounting practice. Our next area of concern with the legislation is with regards to the period of preservation. Now, this is a very minor amendment that this committee could effect. Currently, the draft bill states that political parties and independent candidates should keep records for at least 5 years. To ensure that members of the public, journalists and others are able to access these records and harmonize with other legislation, we recommend that the period of preservation is extended to 7 years, and this would be consistent with other legislation, including the Companies Act of 2008. And I think this would be useful just to ensure that records aren't after a five-year period no longer available and therefore unavailable for due scrutiny. Our next submission relates to the form and regularity of disclosure under the PIE Amendment Bill. The draft bill as it stands right now adopts a similar regime to the Political Party Funding Act, and that is that there should be disclosure every quarter, but this amendment bill does make an additional disclosure requirement that there should be disclosure 2 months prior to an election. Whilst this is useful, in order for this bill to again be harmonized with the intentions of PIA, we believe that the records should be made available on request from the requester whenever such a request is made, so not simply waiting for the quarterly disclosure or 2 months prior to the elections. And this would just ensure that this particular clause revision is consistent with the intentions of PIA rather than creating a strange regime which is inserted into PIA. A reasonable time frame of access, again, should be harmonized with PIA, so it should be 30 days. So should a requester come to a political party, they should be given the 30-day period, which is consistent with other requests made under PIA. Some political parties may say that this may create an administrative burden, but on this the Constitutional Court was clear. The Constitutional Court held that a right is open to be exercised whenever it is so desired, regardless of whatever logistical constraints may exist. So I think in this instance, rights must trump any concerns around administrative burdens. Our next submission relates to the general application of disclosure to other private bodies under PIA. The draft bill, again, just to, I think, to start off by saying, again, the Constitutional Court gives Parliament discretion to go beyond simply an insertion of what was in the court order. We say that in making this amendment, this committee should consider the possibility of extending the disclosure requirements under this amendment to private entities. So in other words, creating a dual disclosure. So it shouldn't just be political parties disclosing their sources of funding proactively, but private entities, companies should also be required to proactively disclose which political parties have made donations to. Such an amendment would be consistent with the scheme of PIA and would also allow for requests for information to be made to both public as well as private bodies. And I think this would be an important amendment in terms of exerting corporate accountability through this amendment process. Our penultimate submission is in relation to the designated official who is required to handle these PIA requests under this amendment process. Currently, the draft bill makes the accounting officer, as defined by the proposed clause 52A, AB, the designated person to ensure that records are recorded, preserved, and disclosed. PIA, on the other hand, generally places an obligation on the information officer, who may then delegate responsibilities to a deputy information officer. Our recommendation in this regard is that the committee should apply its mind as to whether in order to harmonize, again, this draft bill to PIA, there should be more flexibility. So in other words, what you're saying is in addition to the accounting officer being the designated person, this committee may consider creating more flexibility to say should a political party wish to have their information officer be the person to handle such requests, this should be allowed under the current scheme. Our last comments relate more to just our experiences using PIA on a regular basis and what would assist a requester for information. And in this regard, we make two specific points. The one is that Chapter 2 of PIA provides for the application of other legislation, providing for access to information, and this should be specified in a schedule. And so this is often a good reference point for request of information to look at the schedule to say, this legislation allows me to access information through another set of legislation. In this regard, we think it to be advisable for the committee to consider including the Political Party Funding Act under this particular schedule. Our second and very last point relates to Parliament having or exercising its oversight in ensuring that the Section 50 manuals, which are required by all private bodies who must comply with PIA, Parliament should exert its oversight function to ensure that these Section 50 manuals are updated with these amendments. And again, this is very useful for requesters of information to be able to refer to a manual when they're making a request for information rather than having to chase an information officer, or should it be in this instance an accounting officer, understand exactly what they can and cannot receive under PIA. And that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to receive questions.
Thank you very much. Let me start by welcoming members that have joined us, Honorable Mulaudz and Honorable Horn. You're welcome. Honorable members, that is the presentation from Amapungane Center for Investigative Journalism. They have stuck to their time, 15 minutes. I hope also honorable members will be as succinct as possible. Honorable members, Honorable Self, Honorable Glenis, Honorable Hisham Mohammed, Honorable Swart, Honorable Mulaudzi, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation. I'm referring to the first issue of the 100,000 Rand disclosure. It's the point I made during the public hearings on the regulations of the public of the Party Political Funding Act, that, you know, in principle, it ought to be desirable for a political party to be funded by a lot of small donations rather than small amount of very large donations. But with that comes an enormous administrative burden, because in order to give effect to, say, a smaller amount, you would have to employ an army of bookkeepers and at all levels of the party, even down to branch level. How does the presenter see the balance between administrative ease and the requirement for disclosure? And coming on to the closing the loopholes on related party donations. I see under 313, one refers there to a husband and wife. I'd like to think that my wife's donations to a political party are her business, not my business, or vice versa. And obviously it's not only husbands and wives. If you go down that route, you must talk about partners and life partners and so on and so forth. So it does open, I think, a door that perhaps ought not to be opened. Those are my questions.
Thank you, Honorable Glenis Bredenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see you're getting better and better at that. My question is similar to that of Mr. Self, the closing of the loopholes issue. You refer to substantially related sources being defined as a natural person and a juristic person of which the former is a shareholder, a beneficial owner, a trustee, a director, or a partner. Those are significantly different and separate legal entities. Is there any specific reason why you think they should be lumped together like that? You know, what I do in my personal capacity may have nothing at all to do with my position as a random trustee of something or another. And the one, really, I don't see why the one should be able to be connected to or be able to influence the other.
Honorable Hisham Mohammed.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much for the presentation. Just on the slide with regard to prescribed threshold disclosure, you're referring to specified to be the amount we specified in regulations. Maybe you have some comment about the regularity and the degree in terms of regulations comes and goes, that there's certain interface in terms of periods, if we have got any view on that. Then on the next slide, you are referring to funding from party investment vehicles should be included as a source of funding. Would that not be, is it the investment vehicles that, would investment vehicles not be after the fact? what the party does for the money afterwards. And the normal law would take effect in terms of Companies Act and other related legislation. And so what would be the reason for this particular recommendation? Then on the duty to create and hold records, I think I've been partially covered earlier by the Mr. Self, but would this not cause or create the administrative burden on smaller parties in particular, should there not be, in other words, should there not, you go to the court judgment, but I'm sure the court didn't envisage that there should be, or rather envisage there should be a balance between the disclosure of results and administrative burden, especially on non-partisan itself, to at least, we don't want to choke parties dead to this, or anybody to be scared to donate in an open and democratic society. I'm sure that, and then we have noted the 7 years, which is consistent. Maybe there's some reason. You're saying it's sort of line with Companies Act. Why Companies Act? You know, most parties have the terms of office 5 years. I'm not sure about the DA, but in any case, maybe they also. I know the African National Congress has change of or conferences every 5 years but at the national level. Thank you very much, Jay.
Thank you, Honorable Olaudze. Honorable Swart, and then Honorable Olaudze.
Thank you, Chair. Just very briefly, just on the 100,000 threshold, we know that it is set out in the Political Party Funding Act in the regulations. Here it's set out in the Act. Now, your concern is that it is too high. But with practice, it may be that political parties say it's too low. And if it's in the Act here, it entrenches it better than if it was in the regulations. The regulations are much easier to amend than the Act. So I would think, and I'd just like you to comment, that if you keep it as 100,000 here in the Act, it is more entrenched with the possibility. You're saying it's too high, but other people, other interested political parties might find it onerous and say this is too low, and said must go up to 200,000 or 250,000. So would you just comment on the entrenchment of that 100,000 in the Act, which would protect it? Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Mulaudze.
Thanks, Chairperson, and firstly, let me apologize for the arriving late, but thanks to the presentation from Amabungwane. The first question will be out of your presentation when you said you, from since 2010, you were on interaction with the drafter, the parliament, and the civil society stakeholders. I just want to know the cooperation from the parliament and the drafters. How was the cooperation when you interact with them since 2010? The other question is about the threshold of 100,000, which you think is too high. Yeah, so we just wanted to know in terms of you as a Mapungwane, how much do you think is suitable, to be specific, the amount specific you think it is appropriate? And lastly, is about the your investigation through the private emails of the people or politicians. Is that done under bayer law, or you just do it out of your own common sense? Because we saw last time you were revealing so many things. So we just want to know, do you apply to do that, or you just do it? Which legislation is protecting you to do that? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. I think there is no other hand. Can I hand over to you?
Thank you, honourable members, for those excellent questions. I'll try and group, because there seemed to be a theme of questions which came through. So I'll start off with the threshold and do we have a specific amount? Should it be entrenched? What are our views on this? I think that the first thing to say regarding our proposal here is simply that it should be in regulation. This addresses your question, Honourable Swart. The reason why we say regulation is because it allows more flexibility. Your point about, but should regulations maybe change and then it suddenly goes up to 500,000. Our view on this would be twofold. The one is that the regulation process, similar to a legislative process, is a public participation process. And so we would expect Parliament to be to exercise its constitutional duties to ensure that the public may have their views expressed on this. But I think, and what we have chosen not to do in our presentation and in our submission, is to point to specific instances where funding to political parties has led to undue influence or to corruption. And the reason for this was, it was very intentional to ensure that we speak on principle and it doesn't become a partisan matter. Should it be of assistance to the committee, we are more than willing to provide specific examples which may assist members to focus their minds on how this type of undue influence takes place. So that if the committee would be open to having that kind of additional submission of having case studies and examples, that may be of use to the committee. So I suppose our view on this is entrenchment isn't the issue. The issue is we've seen sufficient evidence to know where the risks may be when it comes to donations to political parties. Based on this, 100,000 is already too high because we know the manner in which influence is brought to political parties. So based on already existing evidence, it's unlikely that Parliament could, in all due conscience, make this amount any higher than it currently is. We don't make a specific call on what the amount should be. So we don't say 100,000 is too high, therefore it should be 10,000 rand. I know that other organisations and other civil society have made a specific amount available. What we do say, and that's in relation to the loopholes which we try and address in our submission, is if we're going to have a specific threshold amount, our view would be in an ideal scenario, all donations should be disclosed. But we are cognizant of the administrative burden that could create, and just it would be unrealistic in certain circumstances. So we say that there should then be safeguards in place to ensure that a threshold isn't then abused in any type of way. If the threshold was, however, lower, there'd be less of an obligation to have as many safeguards as we propose in the closing loopholes and gaps section of our submission. And this then potentially addresses the questions that Honourable Self had with regards to the members of the DA had with regards to our definitions and proposals in this regard. We had to come up with some type of working definition on what a substantial related source would be, and this again is based on our work, our investigative work, identifying what type of relationships are often used to either conceal money or buy influence in undue ways. These are some of the examples which we have seen through not just our own investigative work, but the investigative work of other media companies as well as civil society. So this is based on these types of clauses or these types of definitional suggestions to the committee are based on the experiences of what type. So it may, unfortunately, it may be the domestic relationship which is then used to try and hide the fact that money is being given to a particular political party. And so whilst it might not be appealing to have to disclose what your partner is doing in a domestic arrangement, unfortunately cases then show that this type of scenario has taken place. And therefore there's much greater duty when a person or an entity is going to make a donation for these types of relationships to then be disclosed. So yes, I suppose what I'm hearing behind the question is, should the rights to privacy be upheld when it comes to these types of donations? So why should my family or why should me being a trustee on a particular board or company be of interest to the public or to the media? I think the simple answer is we've seen sufficient evidence that these types of relationships do unfortunately cause these types of corrupt relationships, and therefore in the spirit of the Constitutional Court judgment, the duty to disclose this information so that the public can be adequately informed then applies to these specific examples. With regards to the question on party funding investments, we offer a definition, and this is in our main submission, of what a party, what constitutes a party funding investments. And this would be a political party which has got, has made any type of investment where it may be due for some kind of dividends or returns on these investments. Again, we didn't point to specific examples because we wanted to talk to principle and not be partisan, but an obvious example which is in the public domain is the ANC's donations from the Chancellor House investments and what that meant for our democracy. And so we see that this particular type of arrangement for a political party is open to abuse, and therefore, because it's not covered in any other legislation, so for example, this type of investment scheme is not covered in the Political Party Funding Act, Parliament would be wise to ensure that this is addressed in the PIE amendment bill process. This was a concern which was raised by many civil society as well as media organizations in the previous round of submission of the Political Party Funding Act. I don't want to go into that because that's not what we are here for today. But I think there's a gap that's been created in the scheme of disclosure, and this is the opportune moment to close this gap by ensuring that this is covered. Again, we are happy to provide more specific examples to the committee if it would assist you to focus your minds on how this plays out, because I do understand that we are talking in a bit of in the abstract when it comes to our submission. So I think it may be useful if we give a supplementary submission pointing to specific examples of where this happens and how it occurs. On the duty to create records and whether this would be an administrative burden, the Constitutional Court said two things. The one was that because this is of such significance, political parties must ultimately ensure that irrespective of the administrative burden, this information is disclosed because there's public interest in this information being disclosed. The court also said that Parliament should then consider the possibility of some, perhaps consider some kind of threshold, and I think the amount that was quoted in the judgment is 10 rand. And so what we say here is 100,000 is simply too high for the duty to create and hold records. And this is particularly applicable to PIE because what we see, and this is as users of PIE, what we see is that in instances where an entity can say, I can't provide you with this information because the record does not exist, our concern here is that should political parties not create these records below the threshold, then the public's right to information is going to be infringed upon. We may suggest that if it's impossible, and our view here is quite straightforward, we think that political parties, as a matter of course, are going to have to apply basic accounting standards. This is not going to be an extraordinary or a new obligation which this bill will require. All we're saying is that those accounting records should be open to the public. So we're not saying create new records, we're simply saying as political parties create records, these should be accessible to the public. If this committee wants to consider creating a much lower threshold for the creation of records, then that's something that we could perhaps deliberate upon. But our view here is that we're not creating new administrative burdens. We're simply saying as political parties apply good accounting practice, that information should be available through the PIE amendment process. The last point was in relation to the regularity, sorry, that this has been addressed. I'll come back to the period of preservation. Why did we select 7 years? Is it just taking any law which suits our purposes? No. Our view, and we discussed this quite robustly within our team, our view is that we would, in an ideal scenario, rely political parties to hold records indefinitely. But we understood that this was unreasonable. So we decided to do a careful study of other legislation which could apply to political parties as juristic entities. The best example that we could find for this purpose was the Companies Act. And so we're saying that our concern is that if we're limited to just 5 years, that is the election life cycle of a political party. There may be interest from the public or the media to scrutinize records at the end of the life cycle of a political party for that election period. In addition, you've got local government elections which happen at an alternative time to the national and provincial elections. So we say 7 years will be sufficient to ensure that there isn't a gap created in the duty to hold records to 5 years. So 7 years creates a much longer period in which records are held and therefore accessible to members of the public as well as media as well as civil society. The Companies Act just obviously provides a legitimate source to derive that 7 year standard from. We could go for a much more complex mechanism, so consider which types of records should be held for different periods, and I know that other legislation provides for this, but I think that's adding far too much complexity to this legislation. So 7 years is a happy medium of whether or not to have a longer period, a more complex regime of different records being held for different periods, or just the 5 years, which at this point we believe is simply insufficient. The last point relates to our editorial work, and I'll highlight the principle here. The principle one is that we operate in a constitutional framework where the media's got an obligation to report on matters of public interest, and in our investigative work we ensure that we try and close the accountability gap in society through exposing matters which are in the public interest. As an independent outfit, we subscribe to the press code of the Press Council, and that obligates us to operate, get our information in lawful ways. And so we get our information from various ways. It may be through exercising PIA, which we do on a regular basis. It may be through talking to sources, having whistleblowers approach us. But I think the thing to impress upon you is that we do conduct our work in both a lawful and ethical way. So I hope that settles any concerns you may have about that. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. We will surely consider what you have said during our deliberations as we go through the bill clause by clause. So we'll be taking all the inputs into consideration. Thank you for taking time to make the presentation.
Did we get that additional submission that the presenter referred to in writing? Would that be with your leave? She referred to additional document that she'd like to submit.
Generally, we receive submissions until we are finished clause by clause, so you are free to make further submissions. Thank you very much. Can we, Honorable Issa?
Yeah, no, sorry to, I don't want to delay the point. I just want to come back to that part in investment vehicle, because section 52BA clearly indicates that money paid by all persons or entities, certainly in terms of the companies like entities or any investment house, would be such an entity when they have to disclose when they make funding. Why do we need to specifically outline part investment vehicles? Is that already included in the definition?
Yeah. Our view on this is that the current scheme of, so Section 52B, which has a scheme of different records which must be kept and disclosed, does not cover the party investment vehicle scenario, and therefore creates a gap. And I know your view is that it does sufficiently. Our view is that it doesn't. We can, of course, deliberate further on this. And again, in our supplementary submission, I can articulate better why it does not in detail.
Thank you. We will appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. You are released. Our next presenter will be from Alan Gray.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Chairperson and honourable members. At the outset, we'd just like to say that we have full recognition and awareness that political parties are not accountable institutions in terms of the FIC Act, nor the FIC Amendment Act. Alan Gray is making a presentation rather as an interested party and really just sharing learnings that we have as a financial services company in respect of entities who make payments to us, which entities are corporate vehicles, where we actually look to ultimate beneficial ownership and control. We believe that a submission of this sort might be taken into account by the committee and might actually be of use or of value. So rather just a submission for further information and learning. And I'd like to hand over to my colleague, Hermanus Weed, who will take us through the actual submission submitted by Alan Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson, and thank you, Honourable Members. I'm just going to go through the submission on a bullet-by-bullet case, and then I will ask my colleague to jump in when she sees it fit, to also explain the logic and the reasoning behind these submissions. So in terms of our first submission, we also regard the threshold of 100,000 Rand to be too high. Our concern is mainly that it defeats the purpose of fighting corruption and money laundering in terms of the FIC Act and the Prevention of Corrupt Activities Act. The reason why we say this also speaks to our second bullet point, is that what happens often is that money can be split or money can be donated via different vehicles, such as private companies, trusts, and other legal entities. And to effectively determine who the money comes from is one aspect of it, but to also see what the donations are from a particular individual or a particular company is the flip side of that coin. So in terms of the 100,000 Rand, we are not here to prescribe what the amount should be, as once again we are only sharing our learnings and what we have encountered in practice, and we think it would be appreciative if you would consider perhaps a lower amount. I do also understand that from an accounting perspective, and as per the Political Parties Funding Act, the accounting officer and the auditor must be able to trace all records and funding for the particular party and sign off on the financial statements. And that makes it a little bit, if the person or the political party were not to keep all these records, it makes it a little bit difficult to understand how that accounting officer will be able to sign off on these records if they weren't able to see all the different evidence or different assets or money that went into the financial statements. Apologies. It's also, from experience, we've also encountered that thresholds that auditors typically set cannot be used as a justification for why fraud or corruption was not picked up in particular financial statements as per PwC versus Thorough Breeders Association. And then, with regards to our second point, and this also refers to the Political Party Funding Act, Section 8, Subsection 3, and it is in line with the transparency principle as per the court case and also the FIC Act and other corruption prevention legislation and measures. We feel that it should be considered that the political party should be able to determine who the ultimate donations come from, and who the legal entity or who the directors or persons are that sit behind these donations. That's also in line, once again, with anti-money laundering legislation and with global practices worldwide. Once again, we're not prescribing exactly as to how this should be done. We're just raising this as a concern. The last bullet point and the last paragraph I'll take together. The proposed wording also contains no direct mention of gifts, so my apologies if I've misread this, but I did not see any scenarios that caters for gifts that are not money in nature. So in other words, gifts of a house, for example, or a vehicle or technology equipment, etc. And in addition to the above, we would also just like to clarify or determine whether the threshold that was set is also applicable to all of the subsections in 52B, or are they only applicable to money donated as per the first subsection? Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Are you done?
Yes, we have a very brief presentation. Apologies.
No problem. Just before I note, honourable members, I would like to give an update. Rights to know, they are not coming. And the South African Human Rights Commission have asked to come tomorrow. So we will have Alan Gray, and then after Alan Gray, then we'll have James Tunbridge. And that will be the end for today.
I will note hands, honourable members, honourable Glenis Bredenbach, honourable Swart, those are the two.
Thank you. I'm interested in a longer explanation, please, about why you say that it would be in the best interest of voters.
Honourable Bredenbach, can you speak closer to your mic?
Sure. I would be interested to know why you say that in the best interest of voters that the ultimate donors are funds identified and disclosed as part of accounting records. This specifically refers to trusts, legal entities, and other vehicles. It's the same point that was made by Emma Bangani, and my question remains the same. You know, you're here representing Adam Gray. You're doing exactly the same thing. Who are you representing? You got to name every single individual that you represent, and do they all agree with you? Yeah, it's the same kind of scenario, so I'd like a little more detail about that. And why is there this obsession with the 100,000 rand threshold? You know, 100,000 rand isn't that much money. In the general scheme of things, you can't corrupt somebody for 10 bucks, I would hope. You know, it's an economy of scale thing, so I'd like a little bit more detail about why there's this concern.
Did you get that? Okay, Honourable Swart.
Just briefly, you referred to a case, PwC, I think it was, did I hear correctly? And just give us that full reference. And then also on the 100,000, would you suggest another figure? Obviously, we deliberated a lot over this figure. But just you also referred to the FIC and the Corrupt Activities Act, and there the figure of 100,000 is also in terms of reportable transactions, if I remember correctly. You've got the two, know your client and you've got suspicious transactions, and I think the figure is it 100,000, or maybe you can just respond to that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Honourable Stuart. Over to you.
Thank you very much for the questions. So we'll answer the questions together. So the cash threshold reporting amount is 25,000, or it will be sort of updated to 25,000, we hope, in the near future. The suspicious transaction amount doesn't actually have an amount attached to it. That's each accountable institution in relation to the modus operandi or the event system specifically related to a payment made into an accountable institution. So the amounts actually may differ from a suspicious transaction reporting perspective.
Honourable Swart, I'm going to start with you, seeing that my colleague already addressed at one point. The PwC case that we're referring to is PwC versus Thorough Breeders Association, where the court determined that materiality set by the auditors is no excuse for fraud not detected. Perfect. Honourable Breitenbach, thank you so much for your questions. I'll try to speak to scenarios, because I'm more of a risk and scenario type of person, and I hope that makes sense. So in terms of the ultimate owners, I think our concern here is more that people might hide behind shelf companies and use what they call fronting, where they establish shelf companies and they appoint a non-interested person as a director, and then they receive the money via these different people. So in our experience and in our the things that we've seen, it's in the best interest of our clients and of the public as a broad sector and the financial services industry to actually identify who the ultimate donor is, because it prevents people from hiding behind a curtain. And especially when it comes to trust, for example, it's quite difficult to determine who the trustees are and what the interests are and who the ultimate beneficiaries of these trustees are, of these trusts are. So when it comes specifically to political parties, I think the court case was quite clear in this instance that for a voter to make an informative decision, they should ultimately see who has the potential to influence a specific party. So in that instance, we believe that ultimate owners, if it speaks to practices in the other financial services legislation, should definitely, a reasonable effort should be made to determine these. Obviously, and as per the Political Party Funding Act as well, Section 8, Subsection 3, there is an onus on the political parties to make some form of an effort to determine who these owners, the owners or the donors are. And then the 100,000, so we don't have a specific amount that we believe it's best left to Parliament to determine what that amount should be. We suspect that the amount is probably arrived at from the donations tax as per the SARS regulations per individual. I think our concern there, once again, is more scenario-based in the instance where someone in the past might have donated, let's say, R1 million. Now they will go and they'll cut up that R1 million to below 100,000 thresholds and donate in intervals by different people. Because we see all kinds of, as you sit with this legislation, you sit with how it plays out in practice, you see all kinds of scenarios of how people use a system to bypass specific controls. And it's in our interest, I think, in the public as well, to make sure that these controls are embedded and properly working properly to in order to speak to the control environment as a whole.
Okay, no, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you very much.
Sorry, if I may add, it might be of benefit for the committee to perhaps read the FATF's guidance on transparency and beneficial ownership document, which is publicly available. Again, fully being aware that political parties are not accountable institutions, but it does provide quite a lot of international guidance on looking to ultimate beneficial owners and corporate vehicles and establishing standards on transparency to deter and prevent the misuse of corporate vehicles. So that might be helpful for the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honourable Member, it's going to be difficult to run a committee when we open for questions, members don't ask questions, and then when we're about to close them, it's really going to be difficult.
I just wanted to find out on this one of gifts. This one that's saying wedding invite, also, I mean to say, there's no mentioning of gifts to political parties. I just wanted to get more information from Alan Gray as to how the reason maybe why would you want this to be mentioned on the bill, specifically that one of gifts, and how maybe you thought this can be managed, because it's a gift, not money.
Thank you, Honourable Member. So once again, I can speak to practice here. To us, this is a situation of a conflict of interest that can arise from this. So as I've mentioned, the Act doesn't specifically speak to any gifts that are not in monetary form. So if someone were to donate or gift a house or a car or technology equipment or whatever might be the case, it can have an undue influence on that person. It can influence the way they make decisions. And if that is not disclosed as part of the assets of the political party, then it might form a loophole in that sense, because I can donate money and I have to disclose it, but I don't have to disclose if I donate a car.
Okay, thank you very much. That is clear.
Can we get that reference, that document? Just the reference to the document. Maybe they can just submit it to the chair.
Happy to do so.
Okay. You can submit that reference to our committee secretaries. Thank you very much, Mr. James Tunbridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, honourable members. I'm a member of civil society. I represent myself. My submission merely speaks to certain points of concern that I've noticed and I wish to bring to your attention. I shall begin with a brief preamble and just my perception of the proposed amendments. The PIA Amendment Bill of 2019, in my opinion, does little to deal with the disclosures of party funding post-1994. I've also said that nor prior to 1994, which is the period of greatest interest for members of the public and of significance. The South African public have not been afforded, as I put it, the dignity to vote on these amendments to the bill in a referendum. The vote as listed is therefore little more than a whitewash of an entire period in South Africa's history. I make the following observations. Excuse me. In the definitions, 52A, accounting officer, in sections A and B, there is no reference to qualifying skills, educational qualifications, nor membership of certifying organizations. Despite the accounting officer appointing an auditor to exercise oversight over the party's activities and their finances, it is apparent that the auditing profession is in a predictable state. I've said it's rather a corrupt industry. Unless the accounting officer can be held to a higher standard of accountability, undue influence over that position and over the finances of the party may prevail. We then look at the definition of political party. This clause can be interpreted to imply that an entity that has political motives in terms of this definition can or will accept donations if their principal objective does not oppose or support any registered political party or their candidates. Thus, an entity that has political motives may accept donor funds for other reasons, which may buy their silence or non-participation, in which case none of the donations need to be disclosed. We then move on to the body of the draft bill. 52B1A.1. This clause fails to address the case whereby denominations of 99,000 rands or less can be mandated by an organization. I've used the term crowdfunding, but that's perhaps not accurate. As in other submissions that I've recently heard, they would say that you have different channels through which these tranches can be donated or feed into the political coffers. Other forms of donations need to be considered. They need not be financial. They could be donations that assist the party in not having to incur costs through services, providing services, or the use of certain assets. This is not accounted for. The time it takes for corruption to be observed or noted, or where the public may be alerted to such ill-gotten gains, is rather short. It takes a long time. Sorry, Chair, I need to correct myself there. The time it takes, by the time you've noticed corruption and you wish to investigate it, PIA is actually a hindrance to obtaining the information in the first place through obstruction, having to approach a court of law, a higher court, and I had personal experience of this, in order to obtain just the detail so you can proceed with your action. 5 years, it's too short. So we propose then, or I propose, that given the role that political parties play in shaping society, the part they play in the history of this country, that a permanent record be kept of all finances, all donations, in perpetuity. Because in 20 years' time, there may be a situation that needs to be investigated. And if you don't have the data, sponge, because the processes have been frustrated by fire, then there's nothing to investigate. It's business as usual for the political parties. I've made a point about the corporate nature of the city of Cape Town, but I shall defer that to a later date. I rest. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Turnbridge. I will now invite comments, questions. Honorable Jere, Honorable Mufuke, those are the two.
Mine is only one. I just want to point out to the presenter, if he says he wants an open situation of, you know, or 20 years in keeping records, how maybe does he have a suggestion as to how political parties are going to deal with it? To me, it's going to put a burden on the political parties to keep that information. Considering also the issue of these political parties, they have to get donation in order to sustain their parties. So now, isn't that situation going to put more burden in terms of keeping those records for such a long time?
Thank you, Honorable Mfuke.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think my question is also on the 20 years of the records to be kept. You are saying that the records to be kept because there might be a situation. Maybe you need to tell us what kind of a situation. It's either a situation of tracking whoever was donating with those political parties, or you might be having other things that will assist us to understand your 20 years.
Return, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members, for your questions. I have heard your concerns regarding administrative burden, and I pose that to a person with a financial background and an auditor who made the suggestion that the smaller tranches of funds and money to alleviate this administrative burden be limited to electronic fund transfers, and that you can rely on the banks then to assist in alleviating that administrative burden in terms of drawing your reports, etc. When it comes to the 20 years, I did mention in perpetuity, and coming to the point the Honourable Member has inquired of with regards to concerns, yes, it has to deal with foreign influence in terms in policy formation. I think that should be a concern for South African and civil societies, as to how the decisions and how political parties arrive at their policies and how these policies are formed. Where do they come from? I'm not sure. You might have to repeat. This is my first submission, Honourable Chair, so I beg your indulgence. I'm not sure. Have I answered your question, Honourable Member?
That's fine.
Thank you.
Of course, take all of your input into consideration when we deliberate on the bill. In the light of the withdrawals that have happened, Right to Know is not here, and the South African Rights Human Rights Commission will be as asked to present tomorrow. We have come to the end of this public hearings for today. Honourable members will meet tomorrow at 9:30. I'm not sure what it will be. Same venue. So in light of the fact that we have finished early, we would like to take this opportunity to formally establish, I think, the subcommittee. I think the committee secretary will run that particular process, because the problem is that it has not been formally established, so it can't function. So I would want it to function as soon as possible. Can I just ask for 5 minutes of your time so that you can finish the process? Thank you very much. You may be excused. But if you want to stay and do further investigative journalism, you can stay. Okay. Honourable members, I've been advised that all parties have submitted their names for people to serve on the committee, on the subcommittee on correctional services. I would now give an opportunity for parties to advise as to who's going to chair. Committee members have been submitted administratively to the secretaries.
I propose on behalf of the ANC, I propose the name of Richard Janch.
Okay. Any other name?
Listening now. Are we voting now for a chair? 3 weeks ago you imposed him upon us with no vote, no question, no consultation, not even a conversation. We had the courtesy of nothing at all, and now you want to pretend we're going to vote for it? The deal's been done. What are we doing here? We're wasting time.
Is there any other name? Okay. I've been informed that Mr. Chanji has accepted the nomination. No, he did. Yes, he did. He did forward an apology and then he did accept. Okay. Thank you very much, honorable members.
Thank you, Chair. I can confirm.
Thank you.